Let's welcome Aoife Sheena.
Good morning. I am thrilled to be with you all this morning and to look at these beautiful faces at 9:30 in the morning. Thank you so much for smiling at me this early in the morning. I really appreciate it. I'm going to see if I can get up here. Is this a thing? Okay. So I love your intro, Beth. I recognize some moves from class in that intro. I love movement, and more specifically, I really have been blessed by embodiment and being embodied and being an embodied person. And I'm just going to turn. I'm supposed to record myself this morning, so if you just give me a minute. And I'll just start recording my voice. Yeah, I think that embodiment is not only like something that has healed me and something that has allowed me to be in my power. I also think that it is a human necessity. You know, we come to this existence in a body, you know, and we're given many very different bodies. Our bodies show up very different. Our bodies need very different things, and our bodies are miracles in and of themselves. And I believe that the body is home to a life, home to a soul. And so being able to be in it is something that's really important to me and is not something that I've always been able to do. And it has become for me a spiritual practice, one of many that I practice, to be in my body. It's intentional. I used to, you know how you got your shirt on today, you know, your pants. That's how I used to wear my body. It's just kind of something I got up and happened to have on. And so I just happened to be at work in it, you know, I just happened to be talking to my friends in it, but didn't really have a real connection to it. And of course, it wasn't always like that. When I was in, I'm going to take this jacket off. When I was in probably first grade, let me start a little earlier. As a kid in my home before school, before I even started going to school, my family danced a lot. A lot. Everybody danced. I was raised in Dallas, Texas, by teenage parents. My father was 19 when I was born. My mother was 18. And they had both just turned 18 and 19. And I think this was like the time of, my father was a Cameo fan. And P-Funk. These were his, you know, so that's the time frame that they were coming up in. And so this kind of music was playing in the house all the time. And so there was a lot of encouragement to dance and move from my family. And there was a lot of rules, too, about rhythm in my family. So I had rhythm, is what they would say. I had rhythm. My brother did not. This was the rule. This is what they say, you know, Mika, you know, my mother named me Tamika. And so Mika has rhythm, you know. We all call my brother Bird. Bird, he can't keep a beat to save his life. You know, this was the kind of story that was going on in our family. And this started very, very young. And this was just doing stuff that you just do in your family, you know. The snake, the cabbage patch. These are probably dances that many of you don't know what I'm talking about. Clearly the brother on the front row knows what I'm talking about. These are just dances that you just did in your family. They were not the kinds of dances that you perform. They were what we call social dances. They were dances that folks in my community and in many African-American communities just did to certain songs in order to connect and be with each other. And so as a very young person, connection through movement was just normal, regular, every day. And then I got in about the first or second grade, and, you know, they started making you go to PE, which I hated, loathed, actually. And then I found out that you could go to dance, And I, you know, of course it clicked. Oh, I can, remember I got rhythm. So I'm like, I got it. So I, you know, joined a dance class, but it was modern dance and jazz dance. And I was like, what is this stuff? And it had a lot of form to it. And there was a way you stand before you, you know, there was second position and there was third position. You know, there was these, oh, you start from somewhere, huh? And it has meaning and it's assigned a, and you know, it's just assigned a particular way. And that was, I didn't understand that, but it was beautiful to me. And I joined and the teacher was an amazing sister. I can't remember her name now, but an amazing sister that had traveled with Alvin Ailey dance company. And she was teaching these second graders in an inner city school in Dallas, you know, modern dance and jazz dance. And we performed at the Dallas Museum of Art in second grade. And that was when I got introduced to that thing y'all just did. That wow, that audience, that there's energy between me and other people. And as I move, they feel it, and I feel them, and we're doing something, we're having, and I was like, oh, this is life right here. This is what life is about. And I didn't, of course, have that articulation in the second grade, but I knew what I felt, you know, that connection, that energy. And I start with this story because though we're talking about, you know, my personal theology, I feel like those introductions to movement and dance and the body and connection. Like for me, that is spirit and that is source. And that is, I think, on a lot of levels, why I'm here. I often think it's my purpose in this life. I also want to say a little bit of a disclaimer. Beth comes to my class all the time. I actually don't believe in the rules about rhythm. I don't believe in those rules. This was something that my family said and lots of people's families said about rhythm. I believe in time, right? And we are often in different time with one another. And a beat is a beat is a beat, right? And me riding the beat and you riding the beat looks very different. And again, this is more of my, you know, understanding as I've evolved and as I've gotten older, but also my understanding as I've evolved in my practice with my body and in my practice with bodies. Because what I've had to do is move from a place of just me and my body to us and our bodies. And really allowing myself to be humble enough to understand and know that I don't know your body. I don't know what's going on in your body. And it's a gift that you're giving me an opportunity to be with you, with your body, right? Even if what we're doing is this right here. Talking. But if we are dancing and if we are moving together, we're doing it in coordination in some way, I'm honored and I'm sharing with you and I'm learning from you and it's an exchange. So I don't assign things like rhythm, right? And can and can't dance. I don't do things like that when it comes to bodies. I deeply, deeply believe that all bodies want to move. All bodies need to move. And so bodies that often have what some folks call limited mobility, there is mobility. Even bodies where folks are a body with mostly a mind, you know, there are studies that talk about how music and sound impacts folks that can't necessarily move, but the brain waves and the heart and their energy feel it. And again, I'm saying I discovered this as a child, and it feels like the simplest, most grounded way for me to be in connection with spirit and to be in connection with other people. And I kept dancing. I kept dancing. So second grade was like an introduction to like formal, you know, dancing. But honey, I kept doing it. And I joined a step team, and that was a very different kind of move, you know. Who's familiar with step teams? You know what a step team is? Yeah, so for those of you that don't know, step teams are like, they're like a drum. The body is a drum. And the body as drum, and you're doing it again in coordination with people. Okay, so you can make sounds. The body. way more than what I just was doing because I was like, you know, 10 and had way more energy. But there's like, you know, stomping and clapping and yelling and chanting and we're cheering on some level when I was doing it because I was doing it in grade school and in middle school. But yeah, we're cheering, we're happy, we're communicating, we're pumping ourselves up, we're pumping each other up and using our bodies as an instrument to do that. And so that was fun. And that was very different from modern dance and jazz dance, right? And it was very black. It's very black. I didn't see other cultures do that as much or really honestly at all and not in that way. And so I kept with the dance. And as a child around that time, the people around me were Christian, most of them. My mother was Christian. My grandmothers were Christian. And my pawpaw in Kilgore, Texas, was the person that cleaned the church at his church. And so my brother and I got to go to church with him when nobody was in the church. And I don't know about you, but when you're a child in an empty church, it's like a playground. It's like, you know, you're like at Six Flags. You know, we would be up in the pulpit. We would be all in the baptismal pool. Y'all have no business in the baptismal pool. We was all up in there having sermons, baptizing each other. It was, you know, play baptizing each other, all in the pews. I mean, it was like a wonderland, you know, running around this church, all in the choir room, you know. And so I got to see the church in this way through him cleaning it and him taking us with him. And then the man I saw on like a random Friday afternoon sitting in his chair, chewing his tobacco and dipping his snuff was a very different man on Sunday. There was Sunday, there was this poised man who had coiffed his hair with the right pomade and had put his teeth in, you know, his whole top rack, you know what I'm saying? And he had put on his jacket and he looked like Billy Dee Williams or something, you know. He just, there was just this poise and grace, and it was pomp and circumstance getting up and going to church. And I had to get dressed up too. I had to match him, you know. And then I would go and sit, and I would just sit. It's a lot of sitting and a lot of listening and a lot of things that I did not understand. And there was a lot of wailing, a lot of I've been changed. It was a lot of that, you know, and I'm like 8 and I don't understand, but I feel that. I would feel it. And it would probably be the moments that I would be the quietest and the stillest, you know, and then I get back to being fidgety and busy because I'm 8, right? And those are moments that stand out to me most. And that was mostly my experience of spirit and church, you know, and me dancing. And I would just kind of go back and forth between those two. Me dancing in my body and me experiencing Christianity and spirit and faith and duty. And dedication and devotion through watching my papa and watching my grandmother, who is a character in and of herself and one of my most precious ancestors. I have a very beautiful, deep relationship with her on the ancestral realm. We'll talk about that a little bit more later. And she was a sister that nails done. Saturday was in the salon all day. I used to hate that. going to the salon with her, but she was, Saturday was like getting ready for Sunday, you know, and she was the kind of sister that would get into whatever song is playing, you know, and the song starts, and I would literally watch her get up, fix her jacket, and then shout, you know, that was my granny, and I will speak her name, Cassandra Jo Mitchell, Ibaye. I honor her. She taught me charisma, you know, and charismatic, right? Talk a lot about charismatic churches. And I just think she was a charismatic church. She was, honey. The way she lived her life, very beautiful, and very, very, by her own terms. My grandmother was a closeted lesbian, and she didn't tell me until she was 27, or until I was 27. Until I had been kicked out of my parents' home for also for being a lesbian. I remember being angry with her for a really long time about it. And I had an elder tell me, a lesbian elder tell me, can you imagine how painful it must have been for her to have a grandchild that is like her but be afraid of other people thinking that she is like her grandchild so much so that she did not help you? Like, that's how afraid she was. Like, could you imagine? And it helped me forgive my grandmother. And it helped me have compassion for her. The gift of seeing our people as human beings, right? Like, I started realizing my granny was a person, you know? And she grew up in an era where she felt like she needed to hide that. But I saw it all the time, especially in the way she danced, especially in the way she moved, and the way that she talked about other women, and the way she talked about herself and her body. There was a lot of examples around bodies and being embodied that I can make the connection now, but it was really more, I'm just living it and being in it and seeing it. And so shouting as a form of movement, shouting as a form of being embodied, right? When I got old enough to understand shouting, I got very good at it, you know, because it meant surrender. That's not what she told me, right? What I saw was a woman get up and fix her clothes, and what I thought was a performance. Don't get me wrong, there was definitely a performance in it. And there was surrender in it. There was I am so moved right now. I don't have words for what's happening right now. And I don't need them. This space understands that I don't need words right now to express what's going on. And to express what I'm feeling and to express what we're doing, right? And so that is what shouting was. And I watched her shout and I studied it. I can do it right now, right? I know the moves. I know when the head goes back. I know when the head goes forward. I know when the body gives in to the energy. And then I know when to let go and when to stop thinking about it and when to just feel. I have taken off running. Shouting. I used to watch people do that and be like, what in the world? And once I started feeling it, I was like, oh, I know what in the world. It's out of this world. It ain't of this world. That's what's happening. Got it. And I began to practice that as a form of movement, as a form of being embodied, right? And did not know that that's what that was. But it's a deep embodiment when you, quote, allow yourself to catch the Holy Spirit, right? Again, something I watched her do so beautifully. And then I got older, kept getting older, and I did hit around 10, about 10 years of age. And my father had been incarcerated. He went into prison, I think I was probably about 8. And he came home around 10. And at this time, my mother was really, really poor. Very poor. And we were living in a one bedroom. She could barely eat. There have been definitely times where she didn't eat, so my brother and I could eat. You know, she was just really struggling. And he had come home and gotten on parole, and he was dating a woman. And she was, I don't know, of course, how the conversation went, but for whatever reason, they decided that my brother and I would go live with him. And that he would take us for a year is what was supposed to happen. And the woman that he was dating, she had 2 children as well. So their 4 children and this little young couple, they're probably in their early 20s at this time, move into a little one-bedroom apartment. And my father is fresh out of, you know, the pen, and he's Muslim. And I had never heard of a Muslim or Islam or anything like that. But I remember the conversation that he had with us as a family. He sat everybody down and said, look, as a man, I practice Islam. And as a man, my family has to practice it as well. Okay, and this is when he was deciding, you know, that he was going to marry my stepmother and that he was going to raise these kids. And it was kind of like an announcement, you know, the way he did it. Like, just so y'all know, we finna be Muslim. And I was like, okay, I have no idea what that means, but okay, daddy, you know. And I'm a daddy's girl through and through. Look a lot like him, move a lot like him. A lot of that charisma my grandmother had, she passed it on to him. I now have it. You're welcome. And so, you know, he started teaching us. He and my stepmother they got folders and they put all these things inside the folders about the five pillars of faith, and we would sit in the living room. And this is how I learned about Islam. I did not learn about Islam in a mosque or in a masjid. I learned about it in my living room with my very young father as he was learning about it as well. And it became something we did as a family. And so when I stopped going to church, that shouting, that kind of embodiment, that dwindled in my life. And dance kind of went back to being something that I did at a party with my family in the living room. But then there was this other thing I started doing with my family in the living room, right? And it was learning about Islam. And it was praying several times a day. And it was participating in Ramadan. And when you pray, as a Muslim practicing person, you do rakas. Do we know what rakas are? Anybody? They are the bowing, and then you come back up, and then you go all the way down to the ground, and you bow, and you come back up. And you do them a couple of times throughout the prayer. And so there would be this configuration with my family, my father, my young father at the front, and my very young, younger than me brothers with him at the front. And because that gender stuff is in there. And then my stepmother and then my stepsister and I at the back. And we would all stand like this. And we would face east. Right? And my father would call prayer. Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar. Ille, ille, ille la. Ille, ille, ille la. Ashhadu Muhammad Rasulullah. Ashhadu Muhammad Rasulullah. Hayale falat. Hayale falat. Hayale salat. Hayale salat. Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar. Ille, ille, ille la. I still get chills. Literally right now my body feels all of that. It would center my family. And it would center this man who had, struggled with crack addiction and systems impactment and systems involvement. My father went to jail many times over my life. He still goes to jail. My father's 56 years old. He's still struggling with crack. And he's still struggling with the system. But that call would center him. Very strong, tall, dark-skinned, beautiful black man. Huge nose. Power towered over me. He was my tyrant and my first spiritual teacher. And it would center this man. So it was the most powerful thing in the world to me. That call. And it centered me. It brought me into alignment. And I knew what that meant. It meant I needed to come into my body. Because I would need to bow. And come back up. And go down. And I did not understand quite yet what prayer and the body, like what they meant to each other. You know? Prayer seemed, especially in the Christian church, from the ones that I grew up in, prayer seemed like a private thing that you kind of do in your mind, in your head. It didn't seem like the body had much to do with it at all, But Islam, and practicing with my father, the way that we did taught me that there was something else, that there was a full body alignment when it came to prayer, that I was not just speaking and talking, but that there was something about submission and internalizing and alignment that was able to happen for me, not only from the sound of his voice, but from that behavior. When I bow now, I still feel that kind of like humility. And I didn't recognize that as a kid, but that is definitely what practicing Islam with my father and my family taught me. And I practiced Islam from ages 10 to 17. He taught me the Al-Fatiha in both Arabic and English. He made us learn it. I would recite it, but I've already sang for you today, so we're not doing that anymore. It might make me cry again. But yeah, and it's something I still say, the Fatiha. I still say that to center myself before coming up here to talk with you. That's what I prayed, is to the Fatiha, because it just, you know, those are formative years, 10 to 17, and it'll always be something that centers me, that particular prayer. And when I think about the what that prayer means in English, you know, in the name of God, most gracious, most merciful, praise be to God, cherisher and sustainer of the world. You know, it's really like this. It made me think about reverence. You know, I, again, didn't have that word, but that's what it did for me. You know, that there's something higher than me. And I still struggle with submission. You know, I am a genderqueer person. I look like a woman, pretty much move in the world like a woman. I don't experience myself as a woman. But I know and understand that the world does. And so there's all this stuff around what women are supposed to do. And a lot of it have to do with like non-consenting submission to something, you know. So I struggle still with submission. And I understand it as a gift. And I think that I understand it as an exchange. And I do thank Islam for that. And more specifically, I thank my father for that, because he did get a good 7 years of somewhat functioning addiction. You know, he was still addicted, but for a good 7 year stretch, he was able to go to work and raise some children and pay some bills, you know, and have a life. I didn't stay with him for a year. I stayed with him until I was 17. He kept us that long. He tried that long. And when he couldn't anymore, he couldn't. And I was able to go back to my mother. And so, and I, she was, you know, in my life throughout that time. And so was dance. And so during that time in my life, I was also becoming more of a dancer and like almost identifying as one. I had joined another step team in like middle school. And I was really proud of myself. And I wanted to join the drill team because they were cuter. You know, like they had, that, like, you know, their little outfits was real cute, you know what I'm saying? But I didn't make the team, so I stepped, and then I switched schools, right? Because like I told you, I had to leave my father and go live with my mother. And right, it's really interesting, my and his transition, he had fallen off, you know, he had backslid, you know, all that language. And so he was heavy in addiction and was also angry with me for being queer. It's very mad. And my stepmother forced me out of the closet at around 16. And his anger, you know, stuff, his trauma, all of that made him just impossible to live with as a little young, sensitive queer. And so I left because I was like, I'm not doing this with him. You know, I want to live with my mom. And in the course of his transition and his struggle with his addiction, I transitioned into a different home, and this home is not a Muslim home. It's not a Muslim home, right? My mother was a non-practicing, on the couch, reading the Bible, maybe Christian. Had a love for Jesus, had a love for Christmas, and that was kind of it. You know, she talked about singing in the choir when she was younger, her and my grandmother, but that is really about it. And so I messed around and fell in love with a girl. And she went to this church called Inspiring Body of Christ Church, or IBOC. And this was my first experience with a mega church, friends. Oh, yeah. And I had not seen a mega church. Remember, I grew up Muslim, child. Church was my living room, you know, so I didn't know about mega churches and what anything about them. But I liked this girl so much. And to spend the night at her house, to go stay with her, meant you had to go to church. Her mama did not play them Sunday morning sleeping in games. Okay, everybody going to church, including your little friend. And so we got up and we went to this church, and it was huge. I mean, this church is huge. Okay, so I just want to, y'all are definitely outdoing them on the huge level. But it was so big. I had never seen a church so big. And it was like, you know, stadium and two big screens and a band, a whole one. You know, not just somebody with a banjo, you know what I mean? But like an entire band. And the pastor was this really, really short man. He's probably about my height now, named Ricky G. Rush. And he was a high school theater teacher. He's a drama teacher. And so she knew him. A lot of his participants or folks that came to his church actually were students from his school and their families. And so, I get up and go to church. And the first thing I notice is we ain't doing this pomp and circumstance that I used to do with my granddaddy. Like, you know, they're like, oh, no, where would you want to wear? And I'm like, what? To church? I got to put a T-shirt on? Like, you know, her mama had on her Eibach T-shirt and her pins. And I mean, I was like, going to a concert? I don't understand. So I get to church. I see all these people. It is a sea of beautiful black folks. And then the brother came out on the band and he hit the bass. And I was like, oh my God. Like, I was just like floored. I mean, I was on the edge of my seat. The music was amazing. The choir was amazing. They ran in, y'all. Ran from every door. It was like that door, that door, that door, that door. And when they ran in, they came into the front and they were clapping like this. And I was like, where am I? This is amazing. It was all this energy and like the whole, you know, pews, they were also standing and clapping. And it was just, it was such a beautiful exchange. And I really thought I was at a concert for a minute. And then they sat down and there was prayer and, you know, they walked around and did offering. You know, and there was still some of the ritual that I remembered from Islam. There was some standing and some sitting and some standing and some sitting, you know. And then he started telling the word that day. And again, remember I told you as a child, with my pawpaw and my granny, I didn't understand nothing that was happening. Okay? Nothing that anybody was saying. None of the words coming across them pews made any sense to me. But this man had my full attention. Full attention. I understood everything he was saying. And I cried often during that sermon. 17 years old. And I went home and I told my mama, I said, Ma, you got to come to this church with me. And she was like, you ain't never asked me about no church. Like, what, tell me. You know, so I started telling her all the things. I was like, Mommy, you got to come. Please come. Like, let me take you. And I just didn't even remember where it was. But I was like, we're going to find it. It's called Eibach. Like, let's look it up. You know. And so I hounded her for a couple of weeks. And then she took me back. She took me and her went by ourselves. And it happened again. I listened to this man talk. And I was like, oh my God, he talking to me. And they opened up the doors of the church that day. And my mama sat in that pew and I got up and went and joined that church. And that was my introduction to conviction. I learned about conviction in that church. I had never felt it before then. Probably had played around with it, you know. Start thinking about what's right and wrong. And, you know, I shouldn't hit my brother. That's not right. You know, shouldn't manipulate all the children into doing my chores. That's not right. You know, maybe I had some of that, you know, relationship with conviction. But this is a very different, you know, relationship with conviction. This was someone and some energy and some message that was helping me try to be a better person. And that was causing me to want to be a better person. And that was causing me to want to care more. And that was causing me to want to be in connection more. And that was causing me to want to be in relationship with God more. And I was like, you got me. I'm here. And I joined the praise dance team. I sure did. Y'all already know that's what I did. You should have known that. You should have saw that coming. Because this has been my relationship with Spirit. It really has, through dance. So there was a sister that was standing in front of him, Sister K. Webb. And she had on this white dress and it had little ruffles here and there. and an overlay, a red overlay. Beautiful sister, about my skin tone, slim, petite. And she had a tambourine. Now, I had seen tambourines. Remember, I went with my granny. My granny could play a tambourine, honey. She could play all under the ground with a, yes, child, with the stank face and all of that, okay? That was my experience with tambourine. But this sister had a tambourine, and it had streamers on the end of it. And she would do things. Right? She would do really. And I was just like, what is this sorcery? Like, you know, like, I don't, what is happening? You know? And so when they opened it up to the youth to join, I, you know, slicked my ears back and ran. I was like, I'm doing that. And I discovered there's a woman named Margaret Yap. And she created, I think she used to work at Christ for the Nations, but she created a tambourine ministry, essentially. It was, there were patterns that had meanings to them. And you, there was a whole book, and these patterns had, I mean, there was one called Sun Dancer. There was another, Crowning Glory. I mean, they had a Trinity. There was one that, oh, I'll show you Trinity. Trinity looked like this. Represent the Trinity, the three. And there were all kind of patterns like that. Right? And I was 17 years old. And so to be able to go and be, do anything auxiliary at this church, you had to come to Monday school. Yes, it's just like Sunday school, just on Monday. And it would happen in the evening because they had church service all day. Sunday, they didn't have time for Sunday school. So you had to come back on Monday for that. And so I had to go to Monday school. I had to go to church all day Sunday. And I had to go to choir rehearsal on Wednesdays because I had to practice with the choir. And I had to learn these patterns. And I remember the first time they unveiled us because it was new. It used to be, you know, for many years she had did it by herself. But then they had this youth group, and it was four of us. It was four youth. And I stood right next to the pastor. So it would be like the pew, you know, the what is this thing called? That, the podium, that, stand in the middle. And then I was over here, and there was two other girls over here, another girl over here, and Sister Webb was down in the bottom. And so we needed to see her because the patterns, it was like you need to learn the patterns and then follow the leader, right? So you could see in her hand which one she was about to do, and then you kind of catch on with her. And so you needed to study these patterns really well. And so the choir came out and ran out, and then we ran out, you know, and then everybody, and we did it. And remember, I told y'all there was these big jumbotrons, and I'm like 17, used to dancing, used to performing, not used to doing it in a church and in this way and on a screen. And the more that I danced on Sunday, the more that I started seeing that there was this responsibility of me to perform in my life a particular way. And so I remember one Sunday looking down, and it was like 8 7-year-olds mimicking me. Like looking at me. They were not looking at Sister Webb. They were looking at me. And I was like, whoa, what is this? And I remembered, you know, hearing the adults kind of talk about the lives of the teenagers, and, you know, we needed to start a youth ministry because we need to make sure that these youth leaders, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, I'm just dancing. Like, I didn't get it. And then I saw him, the girl, remember the girl that introduced me to the church? Well, she and I, Ben stopped talking. And she had got caught at school with a girl and was in trouble about it. And she had come into the choir rehearsal room while we were practicing. And she just wanted to sit there with us, and she was kind of getting interested in it. And he walked in the room and like, what are you doing in here? And she was like, I'm just, you know, and you get out of here. Get out of here right now. You have no business in here. And I, you know, we're all like standing around like, what's happening? And when she left, he told Sister Webb, she is not to be in here. She is not to ever come in here. We need to talk about it later. But I knew what it was. I knew what it was. You know, it was all around church. And she had got found with a girl at school blah, 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 you know, and they were upset with her for being gay. And I, you know, it made me wrestle because I stood next to him. That man smiled at me all the time. And a lot of people would tell me, you have such a natural gift for this. You're so good at it. You're so beautiful to watch. Your smile is amazing, blah, de blah. But I'm like looking at this man, you know, bless this girl out. I knew who I really am is not going to be okay. And I wrestled for a while. I did. I tried to pray it away, all that stuff. It was such a conflict because when I was there in that church and when I was dancing to those patterns, all I felt was love and spirit and fire and passion, you know. And I tried and tried and tried, and my mom had gotten into the church, and there was all these people were telling me how I had saved her because I brought her back to church. Y'all know how people are. And so so I just had a lot of conflict, you know, at 18 years old at this time. And I had, you know, it's been a good year or so. I was a senior. And I was also a flag twirler in my band. So I had so much dance and movement in my life, you know, I kind of almost couldn't live without it. And being a flag twirler was, y'all, we just like need to have another talk where I just talk about that. Okay. We won't go into all that, but it was amazing. It was an amazing experience. And it really helped. I think it informed some of the praise dance, and I think the praise dance informed it. I think there was a lot of back and forth with it. And so I left. I left that church. And I had a very hard conversation with my mother where she also was like, you got to get out. You can't live here and be no lesbian. And so I had just graduated high school, and I left the church, and I was homeless. And this is Dallas, Texas, you know, so it's not the Bay. You know what I mean? And I had a girlfriend at the time, and she also had gotten kicked out for being gay. And so we were sleeping on the bus during the day, you know, to kind of to stay awake and so we could be awake at night. We ride the bus all day. And, you know, every now and then a friend would take us in and stuff like that. And she was a little bit older than me. She was about 20. And so she had jobs. She had a really good paying job. And about around age 20, because I spent a couple of years on the street, like about 18 to 20, struggling with this sister. And, you know, as a teenager, and I had just graduated and I was trying to go to school. It was a mess. And the girlfriend at the time had some unemployment money coming to her. And so we were able to file for it as income and got an apartment. And as soon as we got that apartment, I got a job. And, you know, and bam, I'm back on my feet, you know, finally. And I began to reconcile with my mother. And the rule for me was, we live in this house together. This is her house. You want to be in my life? You're going to have to be okay with her. And my mother said, this might make me cry, I'm sorry if it does. But my mother said, you know, I looked up about 6 months ago. And I realized I didn't know if you were alive. And I didn't know if you were eating. And I didn't know if you were okay. And I just started talking to Jesus and saying, this can't be what you mean. This can't. And she said she decided that this can't be what Jesus meant. And I need to know where my child is. And I love my child. And I got to, you know, have a relationship with my child. And so she, I think it had been sitting on her heart, like she said, for about 6 months. And she decided that her love of Christ did not mean she couldn't love me. And so we started reconciling around age 20. My mother is a really beautiful human being, y'all. I've forgiven her a long time ago. But also because my mother is someone that has done a lot of work in her life. That moment, she has continued to build on. I'm 37 years old now, you know, and she has continued literally to build on that moment. And I do think that it is about her relationship, her real relationship with Spirit and Source. She's somebody that, you know, we're in the same generation. My mother is only 17, 18 years older than me, you know, and so she's a learner. You know what I mean? Now when I'm telling her all the stuff that I'm doing, she's Googling it immediately later. You know, she gonna Google chakras. She gonna Google, you know, she probably gonna Google the Unitarian Universalist Church because I told her I was speaking here today. You know, that is, you know, she does her best to try to learn and quote, keep up. And at the same time, moving her own conviction. You know, I think she learned something about conviction too, in that journey. And so as I moved on with my life, I decided to come back home. Me and that girlfriend did not work out. And I decided to come back home, which was amazing. But then that itch to get up out of Dallas hit me real hard. And I decided to move to North Carolina with a girl, you know, little young queers. We do this. and so met a girl, moved to North Carolina. And it was the first time that I went to an open and affirming church, which was in North Carolina. And it was Green Street Methodist Church in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. And my girlfriend was a member. And so it was black people, white people, the pastor, Kelly. Oh, Pastor Kelly. That's all I remember. But there was a man that was a Baptist pastor that was co-pastor, if you can believe it. So this Methodist pastor and this Baptist pastor were co-pastor. And the Baptist pastor, black man, oh, his name is Willard Bass. Reverend Willard Bass. And they co-pastored this church. And this brother, he has Cherokee blood in him. So he's mixed race. But this brother would show up with like a feather and his kente vest. You know, like he was so smooth with it too. You know, a lot of pride, you know, dignity that this brother walked around with. And it was a beautiful experience being in that church. It was the first time I had been in a mixed race church and, you know, even mixed denomination. Powerful experience, lots of love, very short services, which I appreciated very much. lots of food, lots of different elders. Some of my elders were black, some of my elders were white, some of them were Asian, and that was beautiful to me to experience eldership with people that were not black folks. It was such a beautiful experience. But I was missing, y'all know what I was missing. I was missing dance. Wasn't no dance up in there. Wasn't no dance up in there. And, you know, that scene that I painted for y'all with my pastor, it broke my heart. It did. And when you leave high school and, you know, you're homeless and you're struggling, you know, access to that kind of joy I didn't have anymore. So I had nowhere that I was dancing, nowhere that I was moving. And to be very, very honest, I was getting bigger and bigger. And I do not say that as a deficit. I'm very proudly fat. Okay, and I use the word fat with a lot of love and a lot of matter-of-factness. It just is a word, right? Like people are tall, like people are black, like people are women, right? So that's what that word is for me. And my body was changing in that way. It's getting larger. And I started internalizing all the stuff that we internalize about bodies. You can get more, quote, differently abled, or your ability, your mobility changes, and you feel a way. I used to could run up these stairs, and now I'm limping. You know, I can't even do them now. I gotta use the elevator. I used to have a lot of breath still when I would walk up this hill, and now my lungs make me stop, take a few steps. You know, I have to use this device now to get around. We all feel it. And then there's those of us that have lived that whatever way, you know, fat all our lives, disabled all our lives, differently abled, some sort of neurodivergence or whatever, all our lives we've never known this other crap that so many of us think is normal, right? And just living in our bodies, being who we are. But I felt a difference. And I felt like movement was inaccessible to me. I felt like I didn't get to do it anymore. And then I found another church. And that pastor was very gay. Probably the gayest human being I've ever met in my life, to be honest. His name is Roger Eugene Hayes. I love him dearly. And he was the pastor of a really beautiful, charismatic, like, mixed, Pentecostal, primitive, like, he was so much going on. He's an old country boy from North Carolina, honey. And, yeah, he had a church, and I started dancing again. You know, because I was queer and it was okay and he was okay and everybody was okay and gay and it was great. And I was like, I want to do praise dance. And he was like, fabulous, because it was right up his alley, you know. And so I started praise dancing. I started performing sometimes before, and it was like coming back to an old friend, you know. And I didn't do it with the tambourine. I did what a lot of us call interpretive dance, you know, or liturgical dance. So it would be songs playing, you know, certain gospel songs. I love contemporary gospel, still do. And I would dance to it. And I remember my ex's girlfriend, they were, you know, this is my ex, but we all go to this church together. And my ex was telling their then girlfriend that I didn't like her, which was not true. We just don't go together no more. Like, I don't not like the new person. I don't know her. But that's what they were telling this woman. And then I remembered it was like church anniversary. And I did this powerful piece to one of my favorite Fred Hammond songs. And I remember that sister's look on her face after I got done dancing. You know, she stepped out of the aisle. And she just looked at me and she said, "Amen." Amen. That's all she said. And, you know, that sister, believe it or not, is now, believe it or not, she's an elder of mine now. That moment solidified a relationship. She's one of my spiritual teachers. She's a little rogue witch now living in Georgia. So she teaches me all kind of fabulous, wonderful things. But that dance, that moment solidified a relationship with her. And that's what I mean, y'all. Really, this whole talk for me is really about moments like that. That what it has meant for me to be someone moving in this body, in this existence, and being in communion and community all the time with my own spirit and other people's spirits, and the impact that it has had on me and all the people around me. I am now a practicing Ifa priest. Ifa is an African traditional religion, for those of you that don't know. Who's heard of Ifa? Okay. Who's heard of Santeria? Right. Gondomble, Lukumi, is that? Yeah. These are all derivatives. These are like, almost like, for lack of a better word, and I really mean lack of a better word, they are almost like denominations of Ifa. Ifa originated in Nigeria. And so wherever the slave ship went and landed, the mixture of Ifa, or whatever indigenous practice, which often was Ifa, there's other practices too, Palo, right? Whatever indigenous of the African, the indigenous people of the land where the ship landed, and the mixture of the colonizers' tradition mixed to make something like Lukumi, right, or Santeria. And the beautiful thing about Ifa is that it survived enslavement. So Ifa in the Americas, it's very specifically in North America, does not look anything like it does in Nigeria. Okay, so you could go to Nigeria right now and find a priest, and they will tell you very different rules about what to do than my godmother will tell you, right? We are practicing here in this country, like I said, what resilience, you know, what survived. I got my first initiation back in 2013. An initiation is a very beautiful, powerful process. We initiate to get in alignment with our divine purpose for being on this planet. This is why we initiate. And so there's lots of ritual, you know, and of course, I know you don't expect me to explain this entire tradition to you in 2 minutes, because you can't explain Christianity in 2 minutes, right? You can't, you know, so I know you don't expect that. And I will say, I found this tradition when I was looking for what did our ancestors practice before. Like, I literally started asking that question. I was a college student, finally, and I started getting curious. I loved Christianity. I loved that church, those churches that I've been to. I loved and missed Islam. But I was curious, what did my people do before? Because the truth, we all know the truth of these religions and what people did with these religions, right? It was a lot of colonizing of people. And so I was just curious. I started asking. And I don't know if you recognize the beads around my neck. They are called ilekes. And I was at a lesbian retreat, and there was a sister wearing some. And I'm like, what are those? And she said they were ilekes. And I was like, oh, what does that mean? And she started telling me about the Yoruba people and Ifa. And I was like, oh, I'm curious. And, of course, coincidentally, me and her were in this space because I was dancing for something and she was dancing for something else, right? And she said, you should ask Carolyn and Harriet. You should ask Carolyn about it because Carolyn is gay and she practices the tradition. She'd be safer. I recognize that. I know, you know. Homophobia is in all the religions. It just is. Just like patriarchy and all the other archies and crap, right? So she was like, go to this person. And so I went to the elder, and she would not be my godmother. She refused. She was like, I don't understand why you want anything to do with this tradition. go away. And I was like, oh, you don't know what you have woke up in me. I am a very determined person. And so I just kept showing up. I just kept showing up. And I started calling her mother. And she's an old school butch from New York. She did not like this mother crap. And so she said, look, in her very thick New York accent, if you're going to call me anything, call me Ia. And I said, oh, okay, Ia, you know. I was in there. Like, I knew it. I got in. And I spent my senior, I turned, like, one of my senior projects into a study in her library. And studied Ifa in her library for a full semester. Fell in love. Found another godmother, the person that would initiate me. And I got it, like I said, I got initiated in 2013. And then I got crowned. So that is a very intense initiation when one gets crowned. And I was crowned a priest 2017. And in this tradition, you are as old as you are crowned. Okay? That makes sense. So, you know, when it comes to indigenous practice, initiation is really about growth. It's growth of a person. Remember, you initiate to get in alignment with your destiny. So this means that I am 2 years on the path of being in alignment with my destiny. So that's actually how old I am in this tradition. I'm only two, right? And so what that means is, you know, I would, if you wanted like a full talk about Ifa, I am actually not qualified. I'm two. Could you imagine giving this mic to one of y'all's two-year-olds? But like, talk about Unitarian Universalist Church, baby. You know, the baby's going to be like, I love my mom, bye. Like, you know, and that's kind of, you know, where I am. So I would love to connect you with my elders if you wanted to know more specifically about Ifa. But what I can say is it has reconnected me with dance in my way. I channel a lot of the principles, a lot of the, quote, deities. Contrary to popular belief, Ifa is a, what is the word? Monastic? I think that's the word. Monotheistic. Thank you. Monotheistic religion. So it does believe in one God. But there are entities of said God called Orisha. And all the energies of the Orisha are just as diverse as there are humans on the planet, right? And so those teachings from the Orisha and the representations and the colors and the energies and the ashe, right, the power of those Orisha, I use in my dance practice. I use it to come back to center. I use it to practice things like being in community. That's one of the things that I love about what Beth has picked up from being in class, right, is that we are a community. And I'm sure Beth has picked that up actually from being in community with you all. But that's something that she and I have connected to. You know, she's brought me in to you all's community because that is something that is a tenet of this tradition and that is a tenet of how I move in my embodiment practice. And I think the last thing I'll say as far as my embodiment practice is dance for me is a part of, it is a tool I use to be embodied. But the practice for me has been embodiment. And I hope you heard that throughout my story, you know, that what I have always been trying to do and what I'll continue to do, you know, the rest of my life is really be here in this body, in this existence, in this experience. And so I use the medicine from all of those traditions, you know, conviction, dedication, devotion, preparation. You know, my granny prepping herself to go in. You know, I use all of that and the teachings of Ifa to be an embodiment practitioner, someone practicing being embodied, and someone hoping and praying that I can join you on your journey and go at your pace. Thank y'all so much. Thank you so much.
Questions? Any questions or comments? Hello?
Thank you so much for your presentation. I felt that I understood parts of your story, and I wanted to know if you had any problem. You've had such a variety of religious experiences. Do you have any problem between people who take their religion literally and people who are more Unitarian, more in your head about wanting to look at things instead of literally as metaphors? And there seems to be such a problem between people who think about the meaning of life, and that's why religion is important, because they want what's important to be their religion, what they focus on, and the people who are detail-oriented and literal is the only way to take anything and everybody else is on the wrong path.
Yes. No, yes, I absolutely struggle with that belief and that way of practicing. Because as you just so eloquently put it, there is a difference. There's a difference in literal and a difference in the metaphoric, and even, I would say, in the metaphysical, you know. And I also have deepened my understanding of what people need to be okay in the world, you know. I think about my mama a lot in this regard, because my mother is Christian, very Christian. And I got married about 6 years ago to a really beautiful woman, San Francisco native. And my mother came. She came to the wedding. And when my wife and I kissed, my mother squinted, you know, but she came to the wedding. You know, there's stuff she needs in Christianity. There's something that Christianity does for her. There's something about certain beliefs about it that she needs. I don't need them. I don't need them beliefs. They don't serve me. And I think that's one small example to me of, like, you know, really the struggle for me is often trying to honor that. Like, okay, that's what you need, and that's okay. This is what I need, though, you know, and that's okay. And that's the best way that I've learned up to this point to kind of accept and deal with it. I hope that makes sense.
Yes, I'm hoping you would expand on fundamentalism in paganism.
Yeah.
Because I find this similar problem
there. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, there are many people that believe that my tradition, that Ifa, is pagan. Yeah, oh yeah. Witchcraft, we're doing things to people, you know? And the ethics of any practitioner is, and practice, no, practitioner, the ethics of a practitioner is often what we are questioning, calling it the religion, right? So we're mad at the Christians that stand outside of abortion clinics yelling that you're going to hell. They believe that it is Christianity that has them doing that. I believe that their practice of Christianity has them doing that, right? And I feel it similarly with people's beliefs about this tradition. You know, I can't say that there aren't practitioners of this tradition that do things to people. There are. But the practice, the tradition, is not set up for you to do things to people. It is about how people interpret and how they use the medicine or the belief or the tradition. You know what I mean? And that's what I push to separate. It's not the tradition. It's not the religion. It is the people practicing it and their interpretation of it. That's what you're experiencing. Yeah.
Hi. Thank you for your clarity and your vulnerability just to share these kinds of things. We underestimate the connection between what we feel when we're talking about our body speaking to us and what we think. And we have some sort of divide between them.
Yeah.
But each one of those reports to and on the other, but it is still one. We are still one.
Mm-hmm.
I am from the South, I mentioned before, and I really enjoyed your description of the charismatic church.
Mm-hmm.
And the power and influence of that charismatic experience. I just want to share one little thing, I started out so mental that the first part of my life was finding out that the body wasn't something to control and to use. And in fact, it's my partner.
That's right.
It's my partner.
Yes.
And the extent to which we treat it like it's a relationship that we're trying to make as good a relationship as we can, then we become whole.
That's right.
And I learned actually this when I was going through some change experiences. You know, as we grow, we end up we hit a wall somewhere and we got to go, I got to fix this.
Yep.
And then we get sincere about learning something. We realize there's something we don't know. And we have to give up and surrender to the experience, whatever it is that will illuminate us. And I realized at that point that when I hit the moment of change, which meant the surrender, I didn't get it mentally. My body told me.
Mm-hmm.
My body told me I got it. I cried. I didn't mean to cry. It was my body saying something about the depth of my experience, in particular the unconscious parts, because we underestimate the extent to which our entire journey, we're kind of riding this powerful, enormous, complex body system with a little executive in the saddle who overestimates his role and over, what would be the word, appropriates the life in that system. And so when we start balancing that, we get better. But I start now looking for the sign from my body when I'm trying to learn something really deep. I have to know that it's going to flow from an unconscious place into consciousness. It's there. It's going to flow. And then I look for the signals to say, okay, there it is.
Yeah.
Because that body has told me I got it. And not only does it say I got it, but it says when you need that knowledge, it will come through feeling. And that's important. I only say that because what you don't know, you can't know by will.
Yes.
If you don't know something, you just can go, I'm going to grit my teeth and knit my brow, and then I will know.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, we do some behaviors that pours it into the body, and when it flows to the brain and comes into consciousness, then we know. And so my whole life is flipped in terms of running my life from my head to trying to discover the larger self. And that's an amazing journey when you can do that. And so the symbolism, by the way, the dance, but we talk about the different systems, the different religions, the different modalities. Some people sing, some people dance, some people use language wonderfully well. But underneath it all is the ability to allow something to express. And to go, I don't know, but if I let it, it'll express. So when you dream, we do some German work. Jeremy Taylor has done many seminars here about dreaming. And to me, there's so much the same about when your dream approaches you with a story. And this wonderful symbolism is there for you to process starting in the morning. And you kind of go, what's going on? And you work with the symbols. Well, dance is another way that this larger self speaks through symbols. So to me, dance is like dreaming. Dance is like the music and melody. They're all the symbolic expression of this large system that is, as Jeremy would say, is here in the interest of our health and wholeness.
Yes.
And I'm just going to stop there because it doesn't stop.
That's right.
So you're fabulous.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Aoife, Sheena. And remember, we're going to have the service now and then our picnic potluck. And then at 1 p.m. here in the social hall, up toward the stage, Aoife Sheena will be facilitating the workshop. You can stand, you can sit. I don't know that you can lay on the floor.
I mean, if you want to.
But if that's what your comfort zone is, then do. But please come, okay? Thank you.
Come
Thank
on
you.
Thank you. Thank you.